We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. KAXE's long-awaited public beach map is here. Find your next swimming destination at KAXE.org. While you're there, you can share your favorite beach with us, and we'll add it to the map. Now for Weekend Edition.
I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Drivers in Bemidji and nearby communities may or may not have noticed new cameras attached to utility poles. Installed by the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force, the devices are automatic license plate readers, or ALPRs. The devices take snapshots, which capture the time, date, place, and vehicle description, as well as plate information every time a vehicle passes by. Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force Commander Dave Hart of the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office says the devices were installed to further investigations into drug trafficking.
But they also serve, you know, a huge benefit to our member agencies of the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force to assist them in their investigations for serious crime, violent crime, missing persons.
Many ALPR systems today use artificial intelligence to process the license plate images into data files. Vehicles of interest are searched by registered users and stored into a data file called a hot list. While Minnesota law dictates how this data can be used in criminal investigations, civil rights groups like the American Civil Liberties Union are concerned that this type of surveillance can be abused. Alicia Granzi, a staff attorney at the Minnesota chapter of the ACLU, explains.
There's definitely a concern that this data is going into databases that can be accessed by federal agencies, in particular, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE. The data is supposed to be used for criminal investigation.
Hart says he understands the concerns, but the task force and its use of ALPRs are in full compliance with the state law.
We're not trying to hide anything. If we wanted to conceal them or make them more covert, you know, we would have done that, but that's kind of not the purpose of them. The company that we're using is one of the largest and most reputable companies for ALPR technology in the country.
But concerns persist, including as recently as this past week. The Illinois Secretary of State issued an order for law enforcement agencies to cease sharing license plate data with federal or out-of-state agencies. The action came out of concern that Flock Safety and its privacy algorithms did not adhere to state law. This is the same company that made the ALPRs placed in the Bemidji area. The same day, the company announced it had ended a pilot program with federal agencies. Minnesota lawmakers initially put ALPR rules on the books in 2015. St. Louis County has 10 that were installed in 2024. The task force's 7 are posted in fixed locations around the city of Bemidji, and 1 is in nearby Northern Township. There is also 1 each in Park Rapids, Akeley, Manoman, and Pine River. Commander Hart says the recent federal designation of Beltrami County as a high-intensity drug trafficking area served as the main impetus for installing the ALPRs, but he notes the technology could also assist in an abduction case. Bemidji Mayor George Prince says the council was not notified about the ALPR installation, but he discussed his privacy concerns with the Bemidji Police Chief.
My quick take on it is it seems like it is a good thing overall and that it aids in investigations, but I'm certainly open to additional conversation on it.
Police in Grand Rapids are using mobile ALPR tech. Grand Rapids Police Chief Andy Morgan says the devices are integrated with the department's dash and body camera system.
Where we are now is agreements between Minnesota and the providers and the agencies using this technology that, you know, allows for that information to flow more freely than it has in the past.
Minnesota law says that data collected by ALPRs can only be compared to a statewide data repository, but Flock Safety promotes its capabilities with a network of 20 billion monthly reads across 4,600 agencies. Granzi says this is worrisome.
It's only supposed to really be pinging with the Minnesota license plate data file. The way that this statute is written, it's like, no, you can't have this central repository. You're not supposed to have that, but they do.
Instances of federal agencies accessing statewide or even national data have put some lawmakers and citizens on edge. But Flock Safety maintains that it doesn't own the data, and it's the agencies who own it and decide how it is shared. Read our deep dive on this topic at KAXE.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The faithful are in pews and clergy in their pulpits today in the Twin Cities, just days after the shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church there. We'll get a taste of today's sermons in just a few minutes. First, we'll lay out the week here in Washington. And to do that, we're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, glad you're with us.
So good to be here, Aisha.
So the Trump administration started this weekend with another strike against this essential pillar of the president's trade policies and really just his policies in general. What has the administration said since Friday's ruling against Trump's tariffs?
Yeah, the White House is defending the legality of the tariffs and plans to appeal to the Supreme Court. I mean, Trump says the ruling, if allowed to stand, would literally destroy the United States of America. He wrote that on Truth Social. And just to step back a little bit, the court upheld a lower ruling that said Trump did not have the authority under what's called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose these tariffs. And for now, though, the court has allowed the tariffs to remain in effect to allow for this appeal to the Supreme Court, which Trump has also promised is coming.
So you mentioned the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which just rolls off the tongue. But I wanted to highlight the word emergency because that's a big part of the way this administration has been moving in all sorts of different cases.
Yeah, Trump and his administration have really been using, you know, this emergency powers so liberally. I mean, since taking office, he's declared multiple national emergencies related to the border, to crime, to drugs, and of course, as an example here, trade. And that was the justification for sending the military to the border at the beginning of the administration, as well as sending National Guard troops to Los Angeles to quell protests about immigration. And most recently, to take over or try and take over law enforcement here in Washington, D.C. And that's something also that local authorities are pushing back on, most notably in Chicago, the mayor, Brandon Johnson, who just ordered Chicago police not to cooperate with any forces Trump may send to the city. And in this court case involving the tariffs, of course, the court wrote that it seems unlikely that Congress intended to grant the president unlimited authority to impose tariffs. So the outcome here of this could really have implications on other efforts where the administration is claiming an emergency.
Is it also an emergency that's sending warships to the coast of Venezuela? Like, what do we know about what's happening there?
Yeah, it's significant. I mean, it's a really big buildup, military buildup in Caribbean waters and other waters surrounding Venezuela. I mean, several U.S. warships have been deployed there, carrying thousands of Marines, either deployed or expected to arrive there very soon. Stephen Miller, he's the deputy chief of staff, told us reporters on Friday at the White House that the military buildup was aimed to, quote, combat and dismantle drug trafficking organizations. And also, Aisha, earlier this month, the Trump administration doubled to $50 million a reward for the arrest of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, accusing him of being one of the world's largest narco traffickers. When asked about the military strikes, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told us that she would not get ahead of the president, but she also said that he is prepared to use every element of American power to stop drugs from flooding into the country.
Tomorrow's the deadline President Trump set for peace talks to be scheduled between Russia and Ukraine, but so far there's nothing on the calendar, right?
Yeah, nothing on the calendar right now. And the French president, Emmanuel Macron, said Friday that if Putin, that's Russian President Vladimir Putin, does not commit this week by Monday to meeting his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, then this is another example of Putin once again playing Trump. And I'll just point out that after the Putin meeting in Alaska, Trump was caught on a hot mic telling Macron that Putin wanted to make a deal as a favor. Let's listen.
I think he wants to make a deal for me. You understand that? As crazy as it sounds.
Now, he's telling Macron there that Putin wants to make a deal for him, as crazy as it sounds. And now, 2 weeks later, Putin keeps the status quo, not appearing to move forward toward a meeting. So it's raising a lot of questions about whether Trump, as he himself has put it, of being tapped along. So it's going to be very interesting to see and watch the next steps that Trump takes.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez. Franco, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark Knoller got his dream job covering the White House during the presidency of the first George Bush, George H.W. The internet wasn't big yet, and the CBS News correspondent was frustrated by the lack of a central database detailing presidential activities. So he created his own, a running record of presidential speeches, trips, and golf outings, later earning him the nickname the Wikipedia of the White House. His work ethic was legendary, and he was once asked by his CBS colleague, Katie Couric,
do you have a life?
This is it. You know, this is this booth is where I spend most of my time at the White House. You know what? I'm one of those lucky people that gets to work at something he loves doing.
CBS reports that Mark Knoller died here in Washington. He'd been in ill health. He was 73. Two children died in Wednesday's shooting at Annunciation Catholic Church and School in Minneapolis. 15 more children were injured, along with three adults in their 80s. Annunciation is located in a community filled with churches, and we sent NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose to some of them to ask pastors what words they're offering this weekend in the midst of trauma and sorrow.
The nearest Catholic church to Annunciation is St. Joan of Arc, where Father Jim DeBraker has been pastor for 20 years.
We had a whole program scheduled around Labor Day, but now I think that what we need is a chance for people to say what they're feeling.
Loss, anger, despair. DeBraker's congregation includes several families whose children and grandchildren attend Annunciation School, so he's starting the Mass with a time of silence.
And then we'll have open mics for people to come up and express what they want to say. And our parish is not afraid to express what they want to say.
Because hearing from each other reminds people they're not alone in their grief. To close the service, DeBraker is using a litany of remembrance he borrowed from a nearby synagogue years ago and usually reserves for funerals.
In the blue sky, in the warmth of summer, we remember them. In the rustling leaves and the beauty of autumn, we remember them. When we are weary and in need of strength, we remember them. When we are lost and sick at heart, we remember them. When we have joys we yearn to share, we remember them.
There's nothing that I can say in my sermon on Sunday that's going to make people feel better about
what has happened.
Susan Daughtry serves as rector of Grace Episcopal Church in South Minneapolis.
Just about every Sunday, I preach about the way of Jesus. Practicing the way of Jesus looks like the way of defiant, embodied, joyful love.
Daughtry's message focuses on the words of a Hebrew prophet.
The reading from Jeremiah this Sunday speaks about God's grief that God's people have given up seeking after the true God, the living God, and have built for themselves cracked cisterns that hold no water.
Weapons of war, she says, that allow obsession with violence to turn deadly.
It makes me think about the ways we trade God's wild and unmanageable love for every single human being for these small, broken, stale little gods, these godlets.
False gods, these guns, that neither bear love nor render justice.
I believe that God weeps with us in the midst of these kind of things, that God weeps with us in any of our tragedies, the same way that God laughs and dances with us when we celebrate as well.
Nate Melcher is pastor at Richfield United Methodist Church, just 4 blocks south of Annunciation. The focus of this Sunday's service, he says, is Psalm 13.
How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all day long?
Ancient questions many in the neighborhood are asking today, with sighs too deep for words.
But I trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me.
Melcher says his hope is that this tragedy will transform this community.
People have a lot of compassion right now, but what we also need with that is that justice, that action. It's both and.
Both care for the grieving and work toward a world in which no one believes violence is their only resort. After inexplicable loss, Pastor Sarah Jensen of Lutheran Church of Christ Redeemer says she often hears people say, God doesn't give us anything we can't handle.
I don't believe that God gives us things one way or the other. The world gives us things, and often the world gives us things we can't handle.
But that doesn't mean, Jensen says, abandonment.
God gives us each other because we can't handle everything on our own. We weren't created for that. We were created to lean on each other.
Neighbors, friends, congregations to buoy each other.
It's really scary to live in a world that doesn't make sense to us. It's scary to live in a world where we can't predict what's going to happen.
The deaths of 2 children and the wounding of many others at nearby Annunciation raises all sorts of profound questions, says Jensen. Where was God? Why evil?
God is good, and yet evil still happens. I mean, it's because we live in a broken world.
Broken, Jensen says, but also beautiful and beloved. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Minneapolis.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Local businesses, you can help defend the future of KAXE and keep people-powered radio on the air with your sponsorship dollars. Visit kaxe.org/give to learn about sponsorship options. A big thank you to all our current business sponsors. Pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. The Clearwater County History Center in Shevlin invites you to an open house for National Grandparents Day, Sunday, September 7th, from 1 to 4. Enjoy a car show, wagon rides, and refreshments. You can even make your own ice cream. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Two civilian workers have been indicted by a grand jury for their alleged role in a fuel spill in Hawaii's Pearl Harbor that sickened thousands of people during Thanksgiving in 2021. The indictment alleges the two provided the Navy with inaccurate information about the spill. Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis held its first Mass since last night, since Wednesday's deadly shooting. The Mass was held in the school gym because the church is still a crime scene. Two students were killed in the shooting. 18 were wounded, nearly all of them children. And Labor Day protests are planned in all 50 states, are being organized by labor unions, and are aimed at pushing back against billionaires and their involvement in the Trump administration. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The federal government is increasingly looking to states for help detaining immigrants. It's a partnership that's growing at an unprecedented pace, and legal experts warn it's pushing boundaries of immigration law. Shannon Heffernan is reporting on this for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit newsroom that covers criminal justice, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
The detention center in the Florida Everglades, you know, it's dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. It's probably the best known example of this state-federal partnership. It's been ordered closed by the courts over environmental concerns. What are some other partnerships that are on your radar?
That's right. Alligator Alcatraz, we've seen news reports recently that they're expecting it to be emptied out. But right before the court made that order, you saw DeSantis, the governor in Florida, make an announcement that they would be opening a different facility that they're dubbing Deportation Depot, and that would be state-run, similar to Alligator Alcatraz. You also have announcements in Indiana for the so-called Speedway Slammer that's going to be opened in a prison facility, a state-run prison facility in Indiana. And you're also hearing rumblings in other states. States across the country are saying they're in conversations, or the federal government says they're talking to people in states all around.
And, you know, I mean, they have these, I don't want to say they're cutesy names, but there's this whole branding thing behind them.
You're exactly right. They use these names, which a lot of the experts I talked about how that can be really dehumanizing. You know, the one in Nebraska, they're talking about calling it the Cornhusker Clink. And that has an effect. That's not just silly. I think that that's a purposeful decision. The immigration lawyers I spoke to really emphasized that legally, immigration detention is not supposed to be punishment. It's a civil matter. And you do hear federal officials raising the specter of being detained in one of these places as something that you don't want to encounter, that you don't want to have to do. And they're using that as a deterrent. And I do think that's part of the reason they're using these splashy names to describe the facilities.
Is it really uncommon for states to work with the federal government to provide detention services in this way?
States have helped with immigration, deportation, and enforcement in the past, but it's been much more narrow. There's these things called 287G agreements that the federal government can make an agreement with a local government, whether that be a county or a state, and essentially say you can act on behalf of ICE in these various ways. Those have previously been fairly narrow, but these agreements are for huge detention facilities. The Speedway Slammer, Alligator Alcatraz, they're holding large numbers of people, and not just for like little short-term holds that you might see in a jail before they hand somebody over to ICE. So the way it's being used is unprecedented. You've also seen them argue in court that these are not just states helping out the federal government. They're actually arguing that these are run by the states. This was really key in Alligator Alcatraz because they were able to say, hey, this is state-run, So we don't have to follow all those federal environmental rules. Now, a judge eventually disagreed with them on that fact, but you can imagine a world in which similar arguments are made in these other state facilities. And those other state facilities are less likely to come up against environmental concerns because some of them are in these already existing facilities. But you could see challenges about like what detention rules they have to follow or who is exactly in charge and has to be responsible for any humanitarian rules that are broken.
Well, how big is the current push for these partnerships, and why would the federal government need the states in this way?
We know that the government has set aside $45 billion specifically for immigration detention. That is a lot of money. And we know that they want to move fast. It is not quick to build a detention center. If you have states who already have prisons or jails that are already built, that offers them a way to act much more quickly and efficiently.
So how is being detained by a state different than being held by ICE?
So I don't know if there's really this expectation that conditions themselves will be worse. I think it's more this legal black hole that they can enter into. For example, at Alligator Alcatraz, you saw that people were not showing up in the ICE detention search, when you can search for if a loved one is detained in the federal system. But they also weren't showing up in the Florida state correction system. And there were legal consequences of that too. Lawyers were left scrambling trying to figure out where do we go to ask for bail? Like who is actually in charge here? And that can be really difficult when you're trying to navigate being detained someplace.
You talked to immigration attorneys and legal experts on detention for your reporting. What was the government's response to your reporting?
So we did not hear back from ICE itself directly on this, but there was this press release that was really interesting where they were saying they were debunking stuff that reports out of Alligator Alcatraz, saying the conditions weren't what the press was reporting. And one line in there that I found really interesting is they said, these are efforts by the media and activists, I'm paraphrasing here, these are efforts by the media and the activists to stop Trump's efforts to use state-run facilities for deportation and detention. So that just really hints to me that this is a strategy that they're invested in and that could become a major pillar of how immigration, deportation, and detention works in the United States.
That's Shannon Heffernan, staff writer at the Marshall Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Students are returning to class. Many of their phones aren't. More states are banning cell phone use during school hours. Teachers love it.
They were really happy to see that students were more willing to work with each other.
And those students, well,
it's annoying.
Classroom cell phone bans tomorrow on Morning Edition. Listen by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Or if you're an adult, listen on your phone whenever you want. Have you spent too much time with yourself this summer? Looking to escape into someone else's life? Well, there's a book for that. Several, actually. Books We Love, NPR's list of best reads, has a lot of recommendations for you, but we'll cherry pick a few nonfiction favorites from 2025 from our colleagues. First up, Felix Contreras. He's host of the Alt Latino podcast and producer for Tiny Desk Concerts, and he recommends Waiting on the Moon by musician Peter Wolf.
Out there in the world, can't you feel the change in times?
I've been listening to vocalist Peter Wolf since the mid-1970s when he was the frontman of the J. Geils Band, and I'm still listening to his work as a solo artist.
You and me.
Now, like so many of his peers, Peter Wolf seems to be using age as a muse to continue his craft of songwriting, and in his case, using life experience to produce a memoir that's truly a great read.
Now, when I was a young man, I believed in everything.
And it makes sense that his book would read like a favorite album, with each chapter playing like one great storytelling track after another. Although his stories challenge the usual rock star narrative to include experiences with art, because he's also a painter, philosophy, books, a short marriage to a Hollywood star, and even a brief NPR mention. But don't worry, there are some way cool and funny musician stories, including the most intimate and loving portrayals of blues musicians John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters that I have ever read.
Still I can't say, I want to tear it all apart, throw it all away. All I'm trying to find is just a little piece of mind.
Hi, I'm Eric Deggans, TV critic and media analyst for NPR.
Lucy!
And I want to talk about the book Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television by Todd S. Purdo. Now, even casual TV fans may know that Desi Arnaz was married to Lucille Ball, and together they created the classic 1950s-era sitcom I Love Lucy.
Dance is fine, honey. We don't want to get over-rehearsed.
Well, I wouldn't worry about that if I were you. Now, come on. I haven't got much time. It's either now or never.
Well, then make it never.
But Desi Arnaz has an amazing, rich life story that Todd Purdom really digs into. He does some amazing reporting and some wonderful writing to bring you into this story of the son of a prominent Cuban family who comes to America, doesn't have much, has to rebuild his life and career, and then eventually joins forces with Lucille Ball to create this TV show that's not only popular with audiences, but pioneers all kinds of things in television. They film it live with multiple cameras in front of an audience, which hadn't really been done before. They record it on film, which allows them to preserve the episodes and rerun them in the future. And they also create a studio that winds up creating other classic TV shows like Mission Impossible and Star Trek. So whether you're interested in the stories of old Hollywood, or you're interested in a classic immigrant story, if you're interested in the star-crossed romance of Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball, and you want to hear about how much they loved each other and tried to stay together and tried to build a business together, no matter what your interests are, you can find them in this book.
That's enough, honey. Well,
come on, I want to do the finish.
The finish?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Claire Lombardo. I'm an editor here at NPR on our Culture Desk, and one of the best books I've read so far this year is called No Fault, a memoir of romance and divorce, and the writer is Haley Melodic. You can probably tell just by that title, a lot of this book is about Melodic's own marriage and her divorce. And the chapters of the book are really vignettes, not just about Melodic's life, but also about the history of marriage and of divorce, and how those topics have been portrayed in books and movies and pop culture. So it's really not a linear story at all. And Melodic really resists any clear narrative or answers or blame that might make the story of her divorce more digestible. And when she is reflecting on her life, she seems to be working out on the page all the ways that she might tell the story. And it becomes really clear that there's never really only one way to tell it. And I found that really moving, because you're left with the idea that what's most important is actually that life goes on. And for her, that's led to a really great book.
Hello, I am Joanna Kakissis. I am NPR's Ukraine correspondent. And the book I love, the book I want everyone to read, is called Looking at Women, Looking at War. It's by Victoria Amelina, an acclaimed Ukrainian novelist and poet, and the book is her only work of nonfiction. It follows women resisting Russia's war on Ukraine. They include a human rights activist, a soldier, a librarian, and Victoria Amelina herself. When we last talked back in May 2023, she was still writing this book.
It's more like a diary, but it's not only my diary, but a diary of lives of these women too, because we all feel like this is one long, horrible day.
Just a few weeks later, a Russian airstrike killed Victoria in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. Her book was only about halfway finished. Her grieving friends and husband teamed up to finish it. The final result includes gripping narratives, diary-style entries, character studies, and raw testimonies. Her notes are incorporated into the second half of the book, which at first seems jarring, but then serves as an intimate reminder of her terrible death. Her voice, however, is so clear throughout this book. I can hear it in every word.
Those recommendations again, Looking at Women, Looking at War, No Fault, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television, and Waiting on the Moon. For the full list of books we've loved so far this year, visit npr.org/summerbooks. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
The yellow brick road is now taking us to the Las Vegas Strip and the Sphere, where the merry old Land of Oz is enhanced by AI. It's a show that opened last week. It looks, sounds, and feels a lot different than when we were kids watching the 1939 Judy Garland movie. Now, some folks have been critical. They don't like their childhood classics messed with. They'd like to release a flock of flying monkeys at this reinvention. I'm joined now by Chris Willman, senior writer for Variety. He's seen The Wizard of Oz at the Sphere in Las Vegas and joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
What exactly is different about this version of The Wizard of Oz?
Well, so much. There's what's happening on screen, which, as you may know, is a screen that's dozens and dozens and dozens of times as large as any traditional movie screen you've ever seen a movie on. And then the other thing that's different is the sort of experiential aspect. They have kind of special effects they would call 4D, where there are things like snow when they go into the poppy field. There's snow that comes over the audience. And when the flying monkeys throw apples at Dorothy and her friends, now there are tennis ball-like apples that are thrown from the rear and gently tap people on the heads. I did not catch one. I was disappointed. But the biggest thing is the tornado.
It's a twister. It's a twister.
There are incredible wind machines that you can't see, but you feel. If you've got a toupee on, you may want to hold on to it because it could go flying off with Toto. And there's debris that circles around in the auditorium during the tornado. So at the end of the show, there are little paper leaves everywhere left over from the tornado.
Oh, my goodness. Like, is it really scary or is it just exciting?
I would say just exciting. You know, if I was 4 years old, I might have a different experience of it. So, you know, parents may want to warn kids ahead of time. And there's a couple other scary elements, too, like flying monkey drones. But, yeah, the tornado, it's intense. You feel it. I was sitting next to a critic who had his notepad open, and the pages were just flapping back and forth. It was quite a sight to see.
So you said there are flying monkey drones in the theater as well?
Yeah. They don't move very fast, and I will say that as much as the flying monkeys have scared kids over the decades, these monkey drones are not that scary. they're just kind of cute. They move very slowly.
Okay. Do you think, though, that there are valid concerns about the idea that AI is being used in this way on this classic film, that it's come for Dorothy and her little dog, too?
I'm of two minds about it. I haven't really settled on that. On the one hand, I think it's a slippery slope. You know, when they start having The Godfather in there and they're adding extra characters or something, I think if people get concerned about that, then there's a reason to be more concerned about this. But I think, you know, The Wizard of Oz was conceived as a popular entertainment. It wasn't an auteur film. And I don't think 86 years is too soon to have a little fun with it.
That's Chris Willman, senior writer for Variety. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You bet. Glad to.
$12 and
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving the Northland for over 25 years on the Beltline in Hibbing. Their service center provides regular maintenance and major auto repairs weekdays from 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. More details online at hibbingchrysler.us. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. The Cloquet Labor Day Parade is Monday, September 1st at 11 a.m. on Cloquet Avenue from 18th to 8th Street. There's also a car show from 10 to 3 at Dunlap Island. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi are among regional leaders in China today. They're attending the annual gathering of the China-founded Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The meeting coincides with President Trump's decision to impose steep tariffs on India because it continues to buy Russian oil. The president of Indonesia has canceled a trip to China. Days of protests over excessive housing allowances lawmakers gave themselves have spread further outside the capital. In Australia, the Sydney Marathon has entered a new era. Today's race was the first as part of the World Marathon Majors Series. Ethiopia's Halemaran Kiro won the men's race in record time, and Safwan Hassan of the Netherlands set a record in the women's race as well. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I'm great. How are you, Aisha?
Good. You know, looking forward to fall at this point. Well, whether I'm looking forward to it or not is looking for me.
That's right.
Will, would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yeah, it was a real elegant one from Bobby Jacobs of Glen Allen, Virginia. I said take the first and last names of a famous athlete, change the first letter of the last name to L, and rearrange the result to get the first and last names of another famous athlete. And I said the first name had six letters and the last name has five. Well, the answer is Simone Biles, the gymnast. Change the B to an L and rearrange, you get Lionel Messi, the soccer star.
There were nearly 700 correct entries, so a lot of y'all got this. This week's winner is Sam McDowell of Boulder, Colorado. Congratulations, Sam.
Thank you so much.
How did you figure out this week's answer?
I think I wrote out six or seven different athletes whose name fit the bill, and eventually got to Lionel Messi and Simone Biles.
Have you been playing the puzzle a long time?
I can't remember. I think 10 or 15 years, give or take.
Yeah, that's a long time. Do you usually submit?
I would say maybe half the time. I used to be a pretty regular submitter, and then work got a little busier, so I haven't had quite as much time.
But you got it this week. What do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
I do watch a lot of sports, so I would say this was a particularly good puzzle for me, and parenting two young kids takes up a decent amount of time.
Yeah, how old are your kids?
3 and 6.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's going to take up a lot of the time, a lot of the time.
Yes.
But they're going to be happy to hear, you know, their dad on the radio.
I hope so. I'll try not to embarrass myself.
No, you won't. Now, Sam, I got to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I think so.
Take it away, Will.
All right, Sam, I'm going to give you some 9-letter words. For each one, insert a letter somewhere inside it to make a familiar 10-letter word. For example, if I said mediation, you could insert a C to make medication. An alternative answer would be to insert a T to make meditation. Here's your first one, imperious, I-M-P-E-R-I-O-U-S.
Is imperatus a word?
No. Sorry. Maybe there should be. It means something that can't be penetrated.
Impervious.
Impervious, you got it. Headwater, H-E-A-D-W-A-T-E-R.
Head waiter?
Head waiter, is it? Pacemaker, P-A-C-E-M-A-K-E-R.
Peacemaker.
You got it. Rehearing, R-E-H-E-A-R-I-N-G.
Rehearing.
It's an activity you might do before a big speech.
I think it's rehearsing.
Rehearsing is correct. Simulated, S-I-M-U-L-A-T-E-D.
Simulated. Stimulated.
That's correct. Geologist, G-E-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. It's someone who deals with precious stones.
Gemologist?
A gemologist is right. How about eternally? E-T-E-R-N-A-L-L-Y.
How about externally?
Excellent. Mind stone, M-I-N-E-S-T-O-N-E.
Minestrone?
The soup is correct. And your last one is implement, I-M-P-L-E-M-E-N-T.
Implement.
This is kind of a weird one. Put a vowel between the P and the L.
Is impalement?
You got it, impalement.
Okay, yes. Now, some of those, I was like, is that
not exactly everyday words, some of those.
Impalement. Were you writing it down, too? Because I couldn't think of it in my head. I had to write them all down.
That probably would have helped.
But how do you feel?
Mixed, I would say.
Oh, you should feel good. You did a great job.
Yes, you did an awesome job.
Well, thank you.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin, as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Sam, what member station do you listen to?
Colorado Public Radio.
That's Sam McDowell of Boulder, Colorado. Thanks so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Mike Reese, who's a showrunner, writer, and producer for The Simpsons. Name a famous English author. Change the first letter of the last name to an S, then move the first, second, and final letters of that last name to go in front of the first name, and the resulting string of letters reading from left to right will name a major American city. What is it? So again, a famous English author, change the first letter of the last name to S, then move the first, second, and last letters of that last name in front of the first name, and the resulting string of letters from left to right will name a major American city. What city is it?
You have your assignment, puzzlers. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, September 4th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
World peace through shredding air. That's the ethos of this month's Air Guitar World Championships held in Oulu, Finland. According to the organizers, wars will end, climate change will stop, and all bad things will vanish when all the people in the world play the air guitar.
The winner is the Angus!
The Angus is hometown hero Apo Rauta. He beat out Japan's Yuta Sudo, a.k.a. Sudo-chan, following an air-off tiebreaker in which each performed to Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. This This is Rauta's first world championship, and the first time since 2000 the winner has come from the competition's host country. This year's prize for being the world's best air guitarist? It's a real guitar, which is strange because Rauta actually plays drums in a band called the Southgates. Competitors closed out the event on stage together. They hoisted the champ up to Neil Young's Keep On Rockin' in the Free World. The competition remains in Oulu and will take place this weekend next year if you want to, as the organizers say, make air not war. Winston Goose never wanted to be a hero.
I didn't want any of this. Not the grief, not the illness, certainly not the heroic voiceover. That's not who I am. But sometimes you gotta do something.
But this janitor is quite literally dumped into the role after his workplace robbery takes a noxious turn. A gunshot to the face and one little dip in a toxic soup, and the timid janitor emerges as the purple pus-filled Toxic Avenger. The new film is a remake of the 1984 cult classic. It stars Peter Dinklage in the title role and is directed by Macon Blair. And Blair joins me now to talk all about it. Thanks for being here.
It's so great to be here. Nice to talk to you.
We know that Winston Goose is a janitor who finds himself a hero, but before he takes that toxic bath, he's a pretty mild-mannered dude. Where do we find him at the beginning of the story?
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of an outsider. He's kind of an underdog. He doesn't have a lot of resources at his disposal, and he's kind of on the receiving end of a lot of different kinds of abuse, either from his insurance company or his job or his just where he lives. He's just having a hard time and he's trying to get by, and in a way falling into a vat of toxic sludge makes it all worse, as you would think. And in other ways, it's kind of the solution to his problems.
And he has a stepson who he's raising and he's trying to build a bond with because the son's mother has died.
Yeah, and you know, in the original, the character was a younger guy, and it was about him kind of being bullied, and he was trying to meet girls, and it's a very singular movie. And I felt like if we did that exact same story of kind of like a 19-year-old, we would be walking too much in the footsteps of the original. And so one of the things that we sort of changed was to make the guy a little bit older and have his whole story be more about trying to hold his family unit together. And so that's sort of the emotional thing that we hang all the jokes and the foolishness on.
Another thing that changed is like the main villain. In this one, it's this pharma company, BTH, but also just kind of like the whole American healthcare system.
If you are a provider, press 1.
Hi, Mr. Goose.
Hi.
Okay, I see you're on the Platinum plan with your BTH employee coverage.
That is me, Platinum.
Yes, which excludes benefits covered under
what?
The Gold plan.
What made you want to put this issue front and center? Because he really needed those Gold plan benefits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a David and Goliath story, and so wanting to give him the most insurmountable possible villain to sort of go up against. So he definitely has to fight like the street criminals and like these sort of cackling weirdo bad guys. But behind that is this huge monolithic system that's impenetrable. And so it just seemed like it would be the steepest possible fight for him to have.
Obviously, this movie is being made at a different time than the first one. Sensibilities have changed a bit since the 80s. Like, there are some, kind of smaller differences, like the tutu that the Toxic Avenger wears. You gave that costume a more positive origin story.
Yeah, I mean, in the original, the bullies kind of force him into a tutu to sort of humiliate him. And in this case, we sort of suggest that It's an old Halloween costume, and the dad is sort of knowingly putting it on to kind of cheer up his son who's having a hard time. And, it was just, that, like, Batman's got to have a cape, Superman's got to have the S, that the Toxic Avenger's got to have the tutu, so he's got to end up in it somehow.
Well, it's kind of heartwarming, though. Obviously, still true to the original, but there is a little bit of a heartwarming element.
I hope so. I mean, like, honestly, for me, I always felt like there was some element of sweetness in the originals. For all the insane gore and things that were going on, there was some kind of sweet quality to those movies that I always appreciated. And that was one of the things that we talked about wanting to carry forward to this one.
You talked about how, like, with the gore and all this stuff, like, it almost is like shock humor, someone getting their arm ripped off.
It's a cartoon. We kind of thought of it as like a live action cartoon. Yeah.
Yeah. But you did stick to the tradition of mostly using practical effects. Was that deliberate?
It was. And, I would say it's, I don't know this exactly, I would say probably like 75% practical. And then we certainly would, we had several effects that were all digital and little sweetenings here and there. But there was something about the original, and this was one of the things that was so, when I saw it at a very young, formidable age, the idea that it was homemade, it was like a movie that struck me for the first time, like, oh, these are like just regular people. It's not Hollywood. They just got a camera and made their own movie. And that handmade quality was a big part of that.
The movie touches on all sorts of hot topics, medical debt and tech billionaires, housing. And there is even a scene which kind of felt really like close to home now, where a group of angry young men take a restaurant hostage because the name was changed from Mr. to Mrs. Meat. And obviously, when we've had all this controversy over the Cracker Barrel logo, I guess, did you want to make this movie more relevant to the issues of today?
No, not at all. And we shot it in 21. I wrote it in 2019. So I think the idea of people being, violently resistant to change, or rich people extracting everything for themselves at the expense of people underneath them, things like this, they never go out of style. And that would be timely if we made this movie in 84, if we made this movie 100 years ago. And if it feels especially timely now, then that's a bummer.
That's probably not a great thing. But the 1984 movie, it had a slow start, but obviously it had eventually attracted this legion of diehard Toxie fans.
Huge, yeah.
It can be hard to recapture that magic. Who did you have in mind with this new film? Is this for the loyal fans or for a new generation?
I mean, for me, the first priority was to make sure that the fans, who are the reason why we're still talking about this movie 30, 40 years later, felt served and felt like that, this thing that they love wasn't taken off in some totally other direction that bears no resemblance to the thing that they love. But at the same time, there's a responsibility to try and reach a wider audience that was sort of trying to do both.
That's director Macon Blair. His new movie, The Toxic Avenger, is in theaters now. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. United Way of 1000 Lakes hosts the Lumberjack Mile and 5K Saturday, September 6th. Registration at 8 a.m., race at 9 a.m. at Grand Rapids Public Utilities. Proceeds benefit the United Way's School Pantry Coalition, a network of 11 schools addressing student hunger with nutritious snacks and weekend meals. UWLakes.org/lumberjack.